position number 11210, reel 8.
Mr. A.H. Watcham, reel 8. When the Germans saw and you were marching through towns and cities that had been heavily bombed, did that in any way show by the way that they responded to you? Did that change?
Well, this was the first time we were stoned, as it were, by the population. They weren't heaving half bricks at it, but obviously they were very upset. I heard later that the city itself had become very lax. It hadn't been bombed for quite some time, and like everything else, their area precaution had become very, very slack. Then all of a sudden, the British came over, the Americans came over, carpet bombing, and that's what we saw outside the city, and just literally flattened the town, the city. And the British came over and finished it off with a night bombing, and we could see they were still digging in the ruins as we marched through the town. As we entered the town, on the perimeters, they had these slit trenches. Obviously, they were going to defend the city. And I can remember seeing they were only kids. They were no more than 14, 16-year-olds, some of them, with bottles of schnapps on the parapet. Obviously, they were bulging, trying to keep their courage up, because the city was in an awful state, dreadful. And they actually housed us in what had been an old-time grammar school. And I remember one gable end was out. You could see the path of the bombing. You know, I understand the Americans, this carpet bombing, they just went in and laid it. And you could follow the path of the bombs. And obviously one pathway took the gable end out of the school and missed the other end. And they put us upstairs. And the place was really unsafe. This is when the first time I was really worried. I even slept with my boots on. I was so worried because the place was unsafe. And we were employed then putting railways right. The bombing was so bad, and we were employed clearing up rubble and rubbish and whatnot. It was pathetic to see the German Fraus, though. The air raid siren would go, and they'd all rush down into the Luftstrom, into the air raid shelters. The all clear would go, and they would come staring out with two cases, you know. They would hardly get down. The air raid alarm, they were in and out. It must have been a really rough time for them, as I say, and the city was in an awful state. It really had been pasted.
When you said that you were stoned, how did that arise? And
Just the column marching through.
Did they come to watch you marching through?
Well, they were busy clearing the rubble up there, you know, and pockets of civilians trying to clear them. I understood later that they were still digging out people who had been trapped and dead.
Was the stoning heavy at all?
No. It wasn't a cascade of stones, but this was the first sign that I'd seen of any sort of animosity towards us.
And were they shouting at you?
Yeah. There was a bit of the shaking of the fist, and, you know, I think they were expressing their feelings, because they must have had a rough time. You know, the city was in a bad state. And they, of course, by the time we got settled in, we started to work and clear things up. Things were getting back to normal again. You've probably seen pictures of trains in India with hordes of people hanging on. You know, the trains that came through, they were on that rooftop, they were on the side, they were terrible. Everybody was trying to get out.
And
we were subjected to bombing one night.
You were the column?
Yeah, well, in the town. And I remember I sat next to one of my Geordie colleagues, and he was telling me what he would do if anything happened, you know, if any bombing started. all of a sudden, the whole of the building was lit up. And I'd never seen this before, and we really didn't know what was happening. But there were these flares. The British bomb, they did the night bombing, apparently. And they dropped these chandelier flares, I think they were called. And it was like daylight. And we still didn't realise what went there, and we could hear the clump. And bits of masonry started falling, and, you know, the whole building shook. As I say, to me, that was the nearest I ever was to, you know, to death. It really was frightening. The first man up and the first man downstairs was this Geordie fellow next to me. He was absolutely terrified. But the Germans wouldn't let us.
They wouldn't let you?
No.
Out of the building?
No. So we stuck it out, and it was really frightening, believe me. To think your own boys are up there, and we blessed them in two ways. One, to get them down, but miss us, sort of thing. You see, with not being at home and experiencing air raids, this was quite frightening for us. We're in an enemy country, prisoners, far from home, and this lot coming down. You couldn't do anything about it, you see.
How far had you come by now?
Oh, we must have come about 1,200, 1,400. We were near the end here. We didn't go any further west than Magdeburg. This is when they started taking us, shuttlecock us back. Because the river, I think it's the Elbe, flows down there.
Was there any signs of some of your German guards deserting or disappearing?
No. Never saw any signs of that at all. Only I saw one day leave the column, but he passed through the town, the village where he lived. Strangely enough, I can remember, I can see him now, yes. But he rejoined the column, yes.
Looking back,
but what had they to do, you see? Where were they going to go? I've read a lot after the war, but you see, they were liable to be shot themselves for desertion. And they were very edgy by this time. They knew what was happening. They knew the writing was on the wall. And they weren't going to knock us around. We were quite sure of that.
How did you look after your feet with such a huge distance to walk?
Well, I took a spare pair of boots with me, you know, and a spare pair of socks, and the best thing I ever did. Funny enough, I went to the local hospital not so long ago to have my feet done, and the chiropractor said, bye, he said, you've got a marvellous pair of feet. And when I told him the story, he said, well, you certainly looked after them. But it was a good thing, because it wasn't easy. See, we were soaking wet sometimes, travelling through drifts of snow, and then, of course, when we got at the end of February, March, the weather got, you know, and the thaw set in. We were in a right mess by this time. We were lice-ridden and weren't very clean, actually. We washed the best way we could, but...
Had you lost weight?
Oh, yes. I was well under 8 stone when I got home. Food was getting very scarce now. The Germans hadn't much themselves. I remember one day, this may take a lot of believing, but I can assure you it's quite true. They stuck us in a barn, Scheune. In the middle of this huge field, and we were really hungry. I'd gone 7 days without bread or anything. You could actually feel your own heart backing up against your ribs. It was really getting really tough now, and we were really getting desperate. And we were in a field that had been newly planted with potatoes, and we decided to create a disturbance. And all of us, and I remember running into this field and down on your knees and scratching out newly planted potatoes. That's what we did to keep ourselves going. It was getting as desperate as that by this time.
You've mentioned the more seriously ill or injured having to wait and hope to get picked up by a lorry. What about the general tone of illnesses throughout the whole march?
Remarkably, we had very, very little. It is an amazing fact. And I think it was survival keeps you going. I've often said when I was captured, if I had known it was going to take 5 years, it makes you wonder what your reaction would have been. But as the year went by, and another year, your survival kit became enhanced all the time. And again, I was in a very privileged position being Vertrauensmann, because I was able to talk to the Germans. I knew what was happening within reason. And I was able to barter not only for myself, mind, for friends as well. But I I got ahead of the column and I got into houses and looked in farms for accommodation, this and the other, as best whatever was available. So I was a little privileged in that sense.
And did the march of discipline get worse as you got in worse condition?
One or two chaps, I did hear that two old fellas escaped, and I knew them personally, actually. In fact, one of them was in the play that we did.
Do you recall the names?
Journey's End. Hardy, I think one of the fellas was. He escaped and went into the Russian lines. Now, this is, you know, second-hand. I don't know how far this is true. Apparently, he was so appalled at the way the Russians treated the Germans. I mean, I understand they would rape anything from a grandmother down to an infant. You know, and you hear stories again after. So there could have been an element of truth in it, but they re-escaped, as you might say, and came back and joined the column when we entered, when we were recaptured. So they found it not to their liking to go into the... You see, that was the only way you could go. If you escaped, you had to go east into the Russian lines. We didn't know how far the Americans or the Canadians were away by this time. It was a matter of chance then.
Were you still pretty certain you were going to survive at the
very late stage? Yes. By this time, we were beginning to suffer health-wise, mind. Hunger is a terrible thing. I know when I got back to this country, and especially when I was teaching and children turned their nose up at school meals, when I recall what I had eaten, God, it makes you wonder sometimes.
You've mentioned potatoes. What kind of things were you eating?
Well, that's what we ate mostly.
Just potatoes.
And we did get issues. You know, I've got it down here, bread issues from time to time.
So it's basically bread and potatoes.
Yes, and that's coffee and that sort of thing. Tea, and that was non-existent by this time, you see. We used our Red Cross. But we did muck in again, you know, and it was a great help then.
In bartering, you were bartering amongst each other as well, were you?
No, most of us.
Just outside?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. When the end came, it was a bit of an anticlimax, actually. As I say, we knew things were happening because the Germans were getting very jittery by this time. And I think they were worried about survival, you see, because they were liable to... bombing and strafing. So they were afraid themselves. The actual end came quite unexpectedly anyway. I remember, you know, I'd done a bit of bartering. I'd gone to this German Frau and I can't remember what I bartered, but I got a bag of meal and some molasses of all things. You know, treacly stuff. And I went down the garden and I built a pile of bricks. This sounds crazy, doesn't it, when you think about it? A pile of bricks, and I found a tin sheet. And I lit my fire and put the sheet over it. And I was eating almost Indian fashion, you know, with the chipolatis in the corner. And there I was with this flour and water. And I'd eaten one or two, and I was absolutely streaming with molasses down in my stubble. I'm really dirty by this time. And I could see these German guards walking down past the fence, and all of a sudden a cry went up from somebody, the Americans are here. So I remember just kicking this fire out, stamping it down and running down the village into the little village square, and there was the I wish I'd had a cine camera, because people won't believe this, they're bang in the middle beside the, what would I have, a monument or a fountain, you know, typical village square, something, was this jeep. And you couldn't get anywhere near it for the German civilians. Shouting and cheering, some were crying, some were laughing. You know, you almost thought they were being liberated. And we managed to push our way through, and there sitting in the front was a, well, how can I describe him? Was obviously a very well looked after American major. Boy, what a size he was, with his driver in a jeep. And we chatted to them and explained what we were and who we were. And then they started rounding up the Germans. It was a marvellous sight to see them rounding up these guards. And that was when we pointed to the ones that had maltreated us to a degree anyway. And we said to this major, well, you know, where's the transport? Where are you going to take us? And I remember he says, oh, geez, if you walk 10 kilometres up... And I remember one of our chaps said, walk 10 kilometres? He says, well, I better not use the language, but we've just walked about 1,200 miles. There'll be no transport. But we didn't realise these were frontline troops, you see. You forget this, you see. I said, just walk up the road, you know, keep going, and you'll meet us, you see. And we'd done about 5 kilometres when if you only had a camera with you, one of our chaps had left the column. We were straggling there. We weren't marching in order. We were just going on. And he rushed into this building, and he came out. You've heard the expression of a man's eyes popping out of his head. It was a sausage factory. And from the tip of his fingers to his shoulders, he had strings of sausages, and he was throwing them like discus, you know. He raided this factory, of course. Everybody was grabbing for them and eating them, you know. He really went berserk just over the sight of food, because remember, we hadn't eaten much. About another 5 or 6 kilometres, we came to the River Mulde. M-U-L-D-E-R, I always remember this. And the bridge was down, and we had to go across on these pontoons. And this was the first time I'd see that these Germans were lying, these dead Germans. And again, you couldn't believe it. You know, we were passing through a front line, as it were, and fighting was still going on. It was a strange experience, really. Once we got over the river, of course, we knew we were then behind the American lines. Not, you know, you can't visualise it as trench warfare, but obviously these were frontline troops.
You hadn't been fired on yourselves, had you?
No. Because out came the chewing gum and the...
What
care rations.
Can you recapture your feelings at that moment when you were burning your chip or your food, or where it was, and then you had this...
Sheer elation, you know. I can see myself yet. I just kicked this lot. And off, down the street. And, you know, as poor as we were, now we ran like anything down. It was an amazing sight.
So where did you finish up at them?
Well, this was on the River Mulde. And as I say, when we got across the river, the Americans took us in charge. We slept that night by the riverside.
What date was it?
This was about the end of April, about middle to the end of April, if I remember rightly. I've got it all in my diary, actually. But I can check that later for you. I always remember it was like Blackpool illuminations. Fellas built fires. And the front line, you know, crazy when you think about it. But, of course, German resistance by this time was absolutely crumbling. There were no aircraft, you know. They were all friendly aircraft and that sort. But we just, and the Americans brought food up for us. And we were eating peaches and cream, you know. And we were violently sick. And I did hear some of our fellows actually died of overeating or, you know, eating the wrong thing. I don't know how far that's true, but certainly I was very sick, very ill. Just, you know, your stomachs couldn't take it. But these Americans were so friendly, so kind to us, knew what we'd probably been through, but... was the wrong thing in a way, you know. We couldn't believe it. These were, when I think of the old field kitchens we had in France in 39-40 when I was a soldier, and we saw these American frontline troops over there, boy. But they were in a very good mood too, because, you know, the war was ending for them as well.
What has happened to your German lead, the lieutenant?
They just went, we never saw them again, they just disappeared. Then, the Americans brought up these big trucks to take us to the nearest town, you see, because we were way up in the country here, you see. And again, you know, I thought, I've been a prisoner 5 years. they put us on these trucks, and this was the first time I saw black troops. And all I could see, you know, there's a little aperture where you're looking where they're driving. All I can remember seeing was this huge black face with this set of lily white teeth grinning at us, you know, and being happy instead of watching where he was going. It was like Dick Turpin's right to you. Boy, we were thrown all over. It was about 40 kilometres, I think. And it was hair-raising. And these.
And what town was this that you went to?
They took us to the town of Halley. You know, the Halley Orchestra, I think, quite a big town, and took us into this, what had been a German Luftwaffe aerodrome.
And this is where you went into the church?
Yes, this is where we were housed, and this is where we stayed. I think I'm right in saying, I've got it again in my diary, we must have been there. Well, I heard VE Day there, and we were getting really chuffed by this time. We could not understand why we weren't getting home.
How long had you been there then?
Oh, we were there 10 days or nearly 2 weeks, I think, if I remember rightly. And we, to begin with, you know, obviously we were in a bad way health-wise. And because each day we were getting that little bit stronger. And I think I told you, I went out and found some cold briquettes and had a real right hot bath. I think that was the best thing that ever happened to me, you know. Get myself cleaned up, because we were deloused and cleaned up and fed and watered. I think we went to the cinema every night. George Raft, Bing Crosby, you name it, we saw them all. You can imagine.
Was this American camp?
In the American place, yeah. I mean, this was not far behind the front line. But you can imagine the contrast, you know, 2 or 3 weeks earlier. We were really at death's door. You know, somebody was in a really bad way. And then here we were going to the pictures and eating peaches and cream and cold beef and all that sort of. It was quite a remarkable change. But we were really confined to barracks. They didn't allow us out.
What were you housed in?
This was the. These were German barracks, you see. So we were allocated rooms where we could. But this, I did hear afterwards, and I've had this corroborated later. The Germans, a lot of them went underground and formed this sort of werewolf sort of, and quite a few Americans were found with knife between their shoulder blades, you know, this sort of thing. So you didn't go out at night, and you went out in twos and threes. You had to be very, very careful. We were quite restricted, and I can understand why now.
But it must have been frustrating.
Very frustrating. In fact, it was almost a riot, because we couldn't understand why it kept us. But of course, we had to go through a quarantine stage. I think this was fair comment. But because we didn't realise that.
Were you medically examined at the stage?
Oh, yes, checked.
And when you said there was nearly a riot, what exactly do you mean? What did take place?
Well, chaps began to shout, you know, we want to go home, sort of thing. And I remember listening to Churchill's speech on VE, on the radio, you see. And it was tough, you know, they were celebrating and we were still stuck out there, sort of thing. And after 5 years, you know, you were champing at the bit to get home. And
had you been allowed to write to your home at this stage?
No. The last letter my mother got from me was 1944 from Germany.
So they didn't give you a pen and paper, as it were, to write?
No. Well, I didn't, anyway. No. But I think by then now, and again, you've got to remember the chaos of all thousands of refugees. Retreating Germans, advancing Germans, bombing. It's hard to picture the scene, and all these thousands of displaced persons roaming all over the countryside.
Was there any fall in discipline then whilst you were waiting? Was there any confrontations between yourselves, or people showing that short tempers? Or
no, I didn't see it. It was pretty. The Americans were very, very good to us. I remember marching in. We were still prisoners, by the way. This is going back a little bit. And behind us, huge barbed wire, almost like a cage. We could see these Americans lounging about. One of them shouted over to me and said, "Hi, Tommy." He said, "How long have you been a prisoner?" I said, "And you know, where'd we come from?" I said, "Oh, we've been 5 years, and I said, we've been marching 3 months, and we've got about 1,200 miles behind. He says, my God, he said, I've been a prisoner 5 days. He'd been shot down over Ploiesti. They'd been bombing the Romanian oil wells. He was still in his flying jacket. 5 years, he couldn't imagine what 5 years was like.
As part of your, whilst you were waiting, as part of your life at this time, were the British coming in to see you and check you and
no.
find out well,
this,
what
this,
you were?
This was totally American. The British were further north.
Was there any documentation being done in this final 10 days or so?
No. Well, they obviously found out who we were and where we were, that sort of thing, but there was no Red Cross officials or anything like that there. No. We spent the time watching the Americans play baseball, which we just couldn't fathom out very, very much. And I say we went to the cinema quite a lot. And, of course, we tidied ourselves up. That was one of the main objectives. And, of course, each day, with good food, we began to get that little bit fitter, and the morale was climbing. And this is when we started doing a bit of bartering again. I got a wonderful Zeiss camera for a pair of boots. And I didn't need, they were Italian boots. I don't remember this.
And who'd you get this from? Who'd you buy it with?
A German. Oh, yeah. A lovely Zeiss camera. And I sold it for £2 when I got home. And Zeiss cameras are the cameras, I understand.
Had Halle been bombed itself?
Oh, yes.
And what, did you see much of the German life that was going on?
No. We had to keep away from the city and the town, if possible. We were allowed out, but not very, very much. We were fairly restricted. And we accepted this in that sense, that it was for our own good. As I say, the front wasn't all that far away, and the wall wasn't over, as far as we knew it, anyway. But then, one morning, a cry went up, we're going home. And we were assembled and marched off to the aerodrome, and we were put on these DC-4, I think it is. And I remember we sat on these little seats all the way down the fuselage. And at the very bottom end was this huge bucket, and some silly clot asked what it was for. We were told quite politely that was it, you were sick. You know. One or two were. I wasn't, but one or two were. We had a marvellous flight home.
What date was this?
This was about the 5th of June, 6th of June. Wait a minute, what am I talking about? 5th of May, 6th of May. So I was prisoner exactly 5 years, you might say. No, 6 of May. No, 5. And we touched down in Le Havre. Funnily enough, it was the very place I landed in France. And this was the first time we saw Germans working as prisoners. Oh, cheer went, and they were all being guarded by black troops. Big black fellows they were, you know, with the carbines. So making these Germans work was a great feeling, you see. Then we were put on the plane again.
Was that straight away?
Almost straight away, yes. And we flew across the Channel. I'm going to get very sentimental here. In fact, I can burst into tears because the American pilots were extremely good. They allowed each of us to go up and sit in the co-pilot seat. And I think the angels must have looked upon me. I was the last one to go up. I sat beside this pilot. It was a Sunday morning, I remember. And my pet subject's geography, so I knew where I was. We flew over Chesil Bank, Selsey Bill, Hampshire. God, what a sight. I've never seen this green and pleasant land. It was really quite something. You could pick out, because we were fairly low, we could pick out the little villages with a church and a spire. You could even see the cows grazing in the field. If ever I felt proud to be British, it was that moment. It was a fantastic moment. After 5.5 years, 6 years, to come back to your own country, and it looked just absolutely perfect. This green and pleasant land, it's a very, very true saying. Oh, it was great. I was very, very, very privileged that day, and I went back to my seat with a big lump in my throat, I can tell you. And we came in near, I think it was near Aylesbury, if I remember rightly. into this aerodrome. And funny enough, the first person that met me was a padre. They came from concert. Little did I realise I was going to settle in concert some days. But then we were driven to a reception area. Then I remember hordes of kids running after us, shouting for souvenirs. And we were throwing out these German marks, and, you know, we kept, and all sorts of souvenirs, which, you know, had we known, you know, there was money to us, and some of the things we threw away, go to these flea markets, now you make a fortune with them.